This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the It Was a Thing on TV podcast. This is the first episode, submission number 001, Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour, which ran from October 31st of 1983 until July 27th of 1984, for a total of 191 episodes. You got your Hollywood Squares in my match game.
Mike, you got my match game in my Hollywood Squares.
Two great tastes that taste great together. Nothing could go wrong with this, right? Unlike Reese's Cups, two great tastes don't necessarily go together that well. Match Game in Hollywood Squares had long lives from the 60s through the early 80s, each lasting over 15 years. So they're two probably of the most popular game shows in history, and then somebody somewhere at NBC said, hey, let's combine the two of them together.
It was like combining nuts and gum.
It was good in theory. I mean, seriously, in theory, but there were some little rules changes, or not necessarily rules changes, but mindsets that Mark Goodson had, which really made the show not that good, or at least part of the show not that good. First, the hosts of the shows, you had Gene Rayburn, who reprised his hosting from Match Game, which he hosted back in the 60s up until the eventual cancellation of the syndicated show in 1982. He came back to do Match Game, which is perfect because he's Mr. Match Game. But they couldn't get Peter Marshall to do Hollywood Squares. Maybe not couldn't, or maybe they just didn't want to get Peter Marshall for Hollywood Squares. From what I've read online, somebody at NBC originally planned to have Gene Rayburn hosting both parts, which would have been interesting. I think Gene Rayburn would have been the perfect foil for the comedy if they utilized zingers, which we'll get into later. Instead, there was an edict that they wanted two hosts, and so did they bring along a host who's had some experience running a game show? Absolutely not. Who did they get, Greg?
They got Bowser from Sha-na-na.
John Bowser Bauman from Sha-na-na. And maybe one of the good things is he didn't play a host in the Bowser character. He was actually formally dressed, didn't have the slick back greaser hairstyle from the 50s. To call him wooden would be an offense to wood. He was real stiff, used the same lines all the time, couldn't really ad lib. He was a competent player at the match game part, but his hosting on Hollywood Squares was robotic, to say the least.
Well, when you watch the original version of Squares, like, Peter Marshall moves the game along. Whenever you watch the Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour on Buzzer, as has been starting to air the last couple weeks, I mean, when you watch John, it's like he's not moving the show along. I don't know if as they get along in the Buzzer run of the show as we go into the next 6 or 7 months, if it gets better or not, but it's kind of you gotta move it along, you gotta keep it going a little bit.
Indeed. The stars got a little hammy, and even on an episode earlier this week, which was from the third week of the show, John Bauman actually tells the stars, you know, like, move along. The champion's trying to catch up or whatever. And even the other celebrities, they took their match game blank cards and started writing stuff about, you know, this is going to take some time or move along or whatever. So even the celebrities involved with the game knew that other celebrities were hamming it up too much, which, you know, may have been fun in the studio, but really was just a time waster and a nuisance. And I honestly, it's from people that you really, well, I shouldn't say people, but at least one person you wouldn't expect. Fred Travellina was bad at doing this, just wasting time doing impressions. And yes, we know you can do Ronald Reagan, and we know that you're the man of a thousand voices. But, you know, we're playing a game here. This isn't your stand-up. This isn't your comedic set. But the one that really surprised me, and she never did this on any other show, was Edie McClurg.
Oh, yeah, you really had a problem with this.
Yeah, Edie McClurg, she had been on the original Match Game. Well, not the original, but the 70s version of Match Game and the 80s, the syndicated version.
I was going to say, Mike, did you have a time machine and you saw all the 60s episodes of Match Game?
I don't want to reveal my secret about my TARDIS. She played it straight. She wasn't this goofy acting out character, and she also played other games. She was on Match Game in 1990 and 91. She was pretty sure she was on Win, Lose, or Draw, other shows of that era, because she was doing the Hogan Family / Valerie / whatever it was called that week. So she made the rounds, but she was just like off the just crazy, just acting really bizarre, goofy faces, goofy voices. Not the, and we really didn't understand them. I mean, there's no backstory. She doesn't have any characters. She's not doing an impersonation. She's just acting sort of like a ditzy valley girl. But that was one really bad thing about the Hollywood Squares portion. The other is that Mark Goodson sort of didn't follow suit with how Hollywood Squares ran for the previous 15, 16 years, where you had zingers, little comedic lines, because Mark Goodson was, he didn't want to feed the celebrities the answers, because that sort of smelled to him like why television and game shows in general got in trouble in the late 50s.
Yes. And if you watch the original Hollywood Squares again, the Poland zingers, the little things by the celebrities after a question is revealed, and the funny joke, and then here's the real answer, and then the contestant says, "Do you agree or disagree?" That was a formula that worked for an NBC for, 14, 15 years, and Goodson's no.
Yeah, exactly. And so what do we get instead? Which one's older, Dolly Parton or the pop-up toaster? Okay, first, what does Dolly Parton have in common with a pop-up toaster? Yeah, she had things that popped out, not necessarily popped up, but, we're going to try and keep this at a clean rating.
Yeah, we don't want that explicit rating on iTunes.
Absolutely not.
We're going to get the explicit rating in, 3 shows.
But yeah, I mean, the questions were like that. It was either this or that, or you had 3 choices, A, B, or C. It wasn't really, there were open-ended questions, but they really relied, especially in the first 3 weeks that we've seen, which is older, A or B. And there was usually some connection between A and B. It's just not a fun game. Plus also, yeah, not yeah, there aren't the funny lines that we mentioned, the zingers. Gene Rayburn takes the Hollywood Squares portion really seriously. He does not goof around there. He explains his answers. He's very thorough. And it's not necessarily because there are no zingers. I think he's just that type of person.
Although he really did have a good line in week two about, was it Tom Kennedy singing?
Oh, that was a great bluff. That was a great bluff. The question had to do with which game show host was a singer for the Cheers back, I think, in the 50s or 60s. And Gene Rayburn mentioned Tom Kennedy's baritone singing voice, which fooled the contestant. But obviously that wasn't like a handwritten line that Mark Goodson or one of the writers would have given him. That was something he came up with on the top of his head. And admittedly, Burt Convy really has never been the most popular game show hosts. He did Tattletales. He did Super Password. He hosted the Match Game pilot in 1990. And then he unfortunately... Oh, he also did Win, Lose, or Draw. But then it's like, what else is there? And unfortunately, he passed away shortly after the Match Game pilot was aired in 19... Or not aired, but recorded in 1990. But yeah, the Match Game part was the Match Game we know and love. Maybe there weren't really definitive answers. Maybe the writing wasn't up to par. But it was the same game that the PM version used. I believe it was in the last... Was it from the start of PM that they played three rounds? Or was that... Was that started when the Star Wheel came around?
It might be the syndicated version they played three rounds.
No, syndicated played two. Because okay, there's two, then the Star Wheel, and then they brought back both contestants, did two more rounds, Star Wheel, then they got rid of both contestants, and brought two new contestants aboard.
Okay, so then it would have been PM.
It was PM. I just don't know if it was in the beginning or if that was added on after the first season, or if it came around in 78 with the Star Wheel. But regardless, they played the Match Game PM version essentially in the main, the Match Game portion outside of the tiebreaker, which we'll get to in a second. So it was just, you know, usual pick A or B. Here's the question. And they included some of the old characters from the Match Game that we know and love. They had Dumb Dora and Old Man Periwinkle. And then there were some other characters, including one whose name got bleeped this week because of a term regarding short people.
Oh, yeah, Billy Barty's estate would not be very happy.
Yeah. Just a hint for those of you who are out of the loop. It rhymes with Gidget.
Sally Field?
Close enough. So yeah, the game played is normal, and they usually got through either five or six questions. So yeah, sometimes the games ended in a 6-6 tie, or just a tie in general. It doesn't have to be 6-6. And they played a new tiebreaker, and I actually like this one. I don't know how you feel about it, Greg.
I like it.
What they did is, instead of doing tiebreaker questions, or what they did in the syndicated version, which would be ask an open-ended question, contestants write down their answers, and the first one to match a celebrity would win, they gave four predetermined answers that would fill in the blank. And by number, 1, 2, 3, or 4, the contestant would say, I'd like number 2, or I'd like number 4, or number 3. And basically, it played out the same way. The celebrities would give their answers, and then the first one to match would win, which I could see for time purposes that being good. It's not bad. I mean, it's actually sort of clever, but the issue leads to going through three, four, five celebrities until you get a right answer. And even on the first tiebreaker, one of the celebrities had matched one of the answers that wasn't picked. I think it was the third celebrity. I forget who it was. But they just played on, and it went another one or two people until, oh, I got, you know, this predetermined answer I chose. Not bad, but obviously not good, because you're sort of limiting the choices for the contestants. And then after that, we get the big transition. We go from Match Game to Hollywood Squares, the back of the second tier, and the entire third tier swings into place, which really was something back in 1983.
Mike, it was very impressive in 1983. But I will say this, in 2019, when I see the rotation and they add the set on, the next part of the set on, I can't help but get the urge to say, let's rotate the board.
I knew you were going to make a Number Wang reference. Beautiful. Beautiful. Well, let's sort of halfway rotate the board.
And then, it's very impressive, because you've got, it's not like the original Hollywood Squares or the Davidson or the Bergeron version, where you had the massive squares with like the stairways and everything. I mean, you have this nice stairway, but I mean, the way it looks on camera, it looks like when you see the whole set together with the squares that light up and everything, it looks like, you know, you don't even notice it.
The best comparison, and I don't know if you've seen this, is if you've ever watched Hip Hop Squares on VH1. It's basically the same thing, except obviously with 2017, 18, 19 technology, they have these LCD monitors instead of, I'm guessing, what would be slide projections back in 83. Slide projections are some sort of, I don't know if it was slide projections, but they lit up the square and you had some cutout of an X or an O. It's sort of the same thing in that regard. But yeah, I mean, that technology was amazing in 1983, and we're going to get back to that in a second, because that was mind-blowing back in the day. Hollywood Squares, like we said, there weren't zingers, and there were some gameplay differences, which helped speed up the game. I actually think they were good for speeding up the game.
Yes.
But also, at the same time, you needed to speed up the game a little bit, because you had a lot of padding and hamming it up from the celebrities. The big difference was when you are in a situation to block a square, if you get it wrong, your opponent automatically gets a square, doesn't have to earn it himself or herself. So that led to quicker games somewhat. I mean, there's some episodes of Match Game Hollywood Squares where they got through at least three full games, if not even a fourth full game. Because, I mean, some of the scores we've seen just in the first 3 weeks, there's been $900, $950, $1,025. But then also we've seen some shows where there's not much right answers happening, and or not many right answers happening. I speak good English.
Thanks, Wes.
There's a Wes Welker joke. I speak Spanish. But the games would last so long that they'd only play maybe 1.5 games. So you'd have winning scores of $250 or $300. But also, there's just been some bad gameplay, because there was an episode, not this past week, but the second week of the series, where there was exactly one right answer in the first 11 questions.
Oh, and Gene basically spoke for everybody. This is a dumb off if I've ever seen one.
Yeah, I mean, Gene Rayburn pulled out the dumb off line for Match Game. 1 out of 11, and I believe the one correct answer in the group actually won game one. So, yeah, I mean, you can attribute that to bad gameplay, just bad luck. Especially, again, since we said a lot of the questions are binary choices. Is it A or is it B? Oh, I'll choose B. Wrong, it's A. Opponent gets the square. And yeah, that actually takes me back to John Bauman when I said he was stiff and just couldn't ad lib. You were right to agree. You are right to disagree. You are wrong to agree. You are wrong to disagree.
You should have disagreed.
You should have disagreed. It's like, okay, there's more than one way of saying that. You come off as robotic, and I don't even remember Peter Marshall ever saying you are wrong to agree or you are right to disagree. It was always, you know, give the answer, circle gets the square, X gets the square. It seemed like John was trying a little hard, trying to maybe get a catchphrase. But, yeah, he was no Peter Marshall. So the games would play until a certain time, a certain number of minutes, and then you'd hear a loud school bell, very reminiscent of a loud school bell, not the corny buzzer or tacky buzzer that was used on Hollywood Squares, the original run.
No, it's the bell they got from the Saved by the Bell opening later.
I don't think you're wrong there. I think it might be the same bell. If Hollywood Squares ended in a tie, they would go to a tie-breaking question, just like the original show used to do. After that, the winner went on to the Supermatch for a chance to win up to $30,000.
What?
Yeah, $30,000. And that was some really good money. That's good money now, but that was like amazing money back in 1983, especially considering the match game. When it came back in 73, the top prize was $5,000. Then it was up to $10,000 when the Star Wheel came along, and the PM version went $10,000 to $20,000. $30,000 was big bucks, and I believe you figured out how much this was, it's worth nowadays through the inflation calculators. It's worth something like $85,000 in our money. You did the math on like 62,800 and said it was like 175,000. So it's almost triple. So 30,000 would be like in the range of $85,000 to $90,000, which can get you a decent house nowadays, or maybe not decent, but considering how much mine cost, yeah, it could get you a house possibly.
Inflation calculator says $30,000 in 1983 and 2019 would be $77,337.05.
Okay, so you're talking Tesla money. $77,000, that's more than a lot of people make in a year. That's some good money. And so the game played similar, not exactly 100% the same as the 70s Supermatch. You still had the top three answers on the board from a survey that was asked to the audience members. And instead of $500 for the top answer, $250 for the second, and $100 for the third, it was $1,000 for the top answer, $500 for the second, and $250 for the third. And if you bombed, and this actually is really a benefit, if you totally bombed, you still got $100.
Money for doing nothing.
If they bombed out on the 70s match game PM version, they did a celebrity match where they went to all six celebrities, and if you matched them, you won $100. And actually, they ended up winning, like, I think $600. They swept the board, and it's like, okay, that's not really fair because, you know, somebody might only get the top answer and win $500, and you totally bombed it, and you won $600. But regardless, so $1,000 for the top answer, $500 for the second, $250 for the third. If you blow it, you still get $100 just so you can play the celebrity match. And actually, that does make sense. So it sounds, you know, I know what you're saying. Oh, you blow it and you earn $100. But at the same time, it's not going to be 2 or 3 minutes of dead air at the end of the show. You're playing a celebrity match where the contestants still can win a nice $3,000. So, as I said, four of the celebrities have 10s, four of the celebrities have 20s, and one has a 30. And that's the multiplier that your winnings will be multiplied by. So 30 times $1,000 would be $30,000, and It even, you know, getting a $10,000 back in the day, I mean, that was like the base top prize on game shows, more or less. Everything was giving away $10,000 if you win, $10,000 if you get the bonus round or whatever, pretty much. And one person, and this just aired this week, happened to get the $30,000 not once, but twice, and on consecutive days.
Yeah, what are the odds, Mike, that you would win $30,000 on back-to-back shows?
Well, I mean, you're asking a math teacher. I don't want to get too deep into the math. I mean, obviously, the first thing you need to do, and there's no way you can put a percentage on it, is you need to get the $1,000 in the audience matches. But then you've got a 1 in 9 chance each time. So if to get the 30 on two consecutive tries is a ninth times a ninth, which is 1 out of 81. So that's a little bit over 1%. And again, you need to make sure that you win the audience match to get the $1,000 in order to even just qualify for possibly winning the $30,000. So it's, needless to say, a long shot.
Yes, it's very hard to get the one celebrity that has the 30 and have a shot at the $30,000. Although, as we've seen in the past 2 weeks and going back to when they had the preview week on Buzzer back in February of the episodes 2 through 5 in the first week, some of these answers are in 1983, if you're viewing it from 2019 odds, you can tell what the most popular answer was in 1983.
If you knew your pop culture references in 1983, you will make money. We've seen that just in the last 2 episodes. Real Blank. There is a very popular show back in the early 80s called Real People. And then Blank Blues. Big show that came around about a year earlier, maybe 2 years earlier, Hill Street Blues. And then Eddie Blank. Biggest movie star probably at the time in 1983-84 was Eddie Murphy. Flash Blank, biggest movie in 83 without a doubt, was Flash Dance. So as long as you know your pop culture references, you're really almost guaranteed to make money. I'm sorry, I want to hear what you're going to say, then I'm going to tell you what I was going to say.
It seems like NBC really wanted to make subliminal references to all their hits, because you have Hill Street Blues, you have Real People, and also you have Eddie Murphy, who was on SNL at the time.
Yes, he was. So, yeah, and that's something that you could really tell throughout the show, is NBC was really grasping for straws, trying to push their shows. A lot of the celebrities were from NBC shows at the time, and we'll just go through the first week, the celebrities from the first week, and you'll see how many were on NBC shows at the time or just finished an NBC show. So, Skip Stevenson was a correspondent on Real People. Alison Arngrim, just a few months earlier, Little House on the Prairie got ended. I'm not going to say canceled, because I don't think it would have ever gotten canceled, but it ended. And so, and where was Little House on the Prairie? NBC. Jimmy Walker, I think, and I'm sure you'd agree, Greg, was looking for a paycheck in 1983.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Good Times was over.
Good Times was over, and his dynamite catchphrase was sort of like waning in popularity.
Yeah, that phrase wouldn't be like useful on television until AEW said, "What should we name our show?" And then they were probably watching Good Times and heard Jimmy Walker say dynamite, like, "Dynamite! That's it!"
It's a good thing they weren't watching What's Happening. Hey!
AEW rerun just does not sound very good.
AEW, hey! we get to one of Greg's favorites now, Twyla Littleton. She appeared in some shows. She was never a big star. But we'll get into Twyla in a little bit with a theory that I have regarding celebrities. Phil Proctor. What was Phil Proctor doing in 1983? Because, as you've mentioned, he was the voice of the father on Rugrats, but that wouldn't be for another 8 years or so.
He was the father of Phil and Lil.
Yeah, but what was he doing in 1983?
That's the question we have with a lot of these celebrities when we see the episode guides. Like, what the heck were some of these celebrities doing?
And honestly, I'm just doing a little search on Wikipedia, which of course is a great academic reference. Use it forever, kids. No, don't trust me because I'm a teacher and I've seen too much wacky stuff go on with students citing Wikipedia. Let's see, in terms of television shows, Richie Rich would have been around that time.
Wait, there was a live-action Richie Rich?
No, animated version, animated.
That's all like Gene Wood can say from Richie Rich, Phil Proctor.
The Smurfs?
Okay, well, that's an NBC show.
That's an NBC show, exactly. And that would have started probably about 82, 83 and was definitely probably the most popular cartoon on NBC at the time. That's all I can see for that time frame. He did announce on Big Brother for 3 seasons. I didn't know that. That's sort of a surprise to me. But yeah, so Phil Proctor, who went on to decent stuff, again, you may not know the name, but you know the voice for sure. And then Tom Villard, who was on We've Got It Made, NBC show. And then Barbie Benton, who we'll get into my special category in a second.
Yeah.
And then finally Bill Daly, who was a regular on Match Game in the 70s and the early 80s. So, I mean, he almost has like, just like carte blanche to go to Match Game whenever he wants.
Yeah,
he wouldn't have been on the Bob Newhart show. That would have been canceled years before. So at least you had some old family members, if you will, visiting the new show.
And to their credit, they did bring Charles Nelson Reilly back for a couple of weeks. They brought Fanny Flagg. They even brought back George Gobel for a week from Hollywood Squares and Abby Dalton back for a week from Hollywood Squares. So they did try to make some connections with both shows.
Yeah, and one thing that I've noticed is the celebrities who are good on Hollywood Squares were horrible on Match Game, and essentially vice versa. I mean, they are two diametrically opposed games. One is actually sort of knowledge-based, and the other is, can you, your mind be on the same wavelength as somebody else. So it was sort of catastrophic in that regard, you know, trying to see George Gobel play Match Game when he was absolutely not a good player at it. But also, George Gobel didn't have the zingers. That goes back to what we talked about earlier. I mean, George Gobel could do a heck of a zinger, but the problem is when Mark Goodson says, we're not doing zingers, then you're sort of grasping at straws. Some of the old timers were back, and they did try introducing new timers or new people, and obviously there was a lot of promotion for the NBC shows, because we just mentioned that 3 of the celebrities, at least in the premiere week, were on NBC shows at the time, or just ended their runs on NBC shows. And yeah, they did similar. They did weeks. There was a St. Elsewhere week, and they had 8 cast members from St. Elsewhere. But also, they promoted other shows, too. They had a Too Close for Comfort week.
That was awesome.
Which is good, except Too Close for Comfort only has really 5 stars. So you had to fill in other slots with Arsenio Hall and
Bart Braverman.
Yeah, Bart Braverman, And I forget who the token female was that week. I'm looking at it right now. Oh, it was Elise Knight. It was Ted Knight's daughter.
Oh, that's nice.
Who I don't even think was on the show. I used to watch Too Close for Comfort reruns quite a bit the last number of years, and I don't remember Elise Knight being on the show. But also, one week, there's also a 50s week, a tribute to the 50s with Fabian. And I actually remember this when it originally aired for some reason. Fabian and other 50s celebrities were in the on the panel. But the one week which might be the most maybe famous slash infamous week, which we should see in about 6 weeks, so right around Thanksgiving, maybe a little bit after, it was from December 26th to December 30th of 1983. It was a tribute to Leave It to Beaver. And the people who were on the panel that week, you had Jerry Mathers as the Beav. You had Barbara Billingsley, who played the mother. She played June. And then Frank Bank, who played Lumpy. And some other names, I don't remember who they played on the show, but Jerry Weil and Rich Carrell and Richard Deacon, who are all on Leave It to Beaver. And then you have the ninth celebrity after you include John Bauman or Gene Rayburn. And who symbolizes Leave It to Beaver better than... Say it, Greg.
Gallagher.
Gallagher! I get Gallagher was a big comic back in 1983. He had a lot of specials on Showtime, and he was known for, you know, using his sledgehammer to absolutely pound melons into submission. But Gallagher has nothing to do with Leave It to Beaver. I mean,
you know, Mike, you think that after each show, like, he would, at the end of the Friday show, they'd have Gallagher do the watermelon smash?
You'd think they would. Seriously, you brought him on there. What's he known for? He's known for smashing watermelons.
And we've all talked about this. The week they had seen elsewhere, you think Howie Mandel did the rubber glove trick on his head at least once that week?
That was his thing. Now, we've only seen one episode from that week, so there's a possibility he may have done it later on in the week as a time killer. But, yeah, you'd think that, you know, these comics would do stuff that they're known for. It almost feels like, oh, hey, we have an empty seat. Let's see who we can get here for five episode tapings on a weekend. Oh, look, Gallagher's in town. He's doing the Chuckle Hut or whatever in Laguna Beach. Okay, let's get Gallagher on. Makes no sense.
No, I think it makes perfect sense.
Gallagher has nothing to do with Leave It to Beaver.
Maybe he's a big fan of Leave It to Beaver, Mike.
Well, who's not a fan of Leave It to Beaver? But, I mean, you know, that just doesn't mean, okay, I'm a big fan of Leave It to Beaver. Hey, let's call up this, you know, no-name schmo from the audience and let him play the game. It's just, it's like mixing oil and water. It just doesn't mesh. It doesn't combine. But, yeah, so that was one of the more interesting pairings, maybe in history, honestly, the Leave It to Beaver week with Gallagher. Another thing about the celebrities, I mentioned this earlier with Twyla Littleton and Barbie Benton, is we noticed that, or at least I noticed, that there's like a token bimbo of the week on almost every panel, at least for the first maybe 3 months. Examples. I'm going to put Twyla Littleton in there, even though it doesn't say anywhere that she did any sort of magazines. But Barbie Benton certainly did. Week two, Shannon Tweed certainly did.
And week three, we all know, even though there really isn't anyone that you consider a bimbo, by default, Lydia Cornell was the bimbo of the week.
No! Take that back. Lydia Cornell played a college student on Too Close for Comfort. How dare you say that?
Listen, I love Lydia Cornell. You know, I love her, but we didn't have a bimbo. We had to have someone occupy that seat. We had to have someone be the acting bimbo.
Well, I'm going to give Greg credit there, because the other two females on the panel that week were Edie McClurg, who's definitely not a token bimbo, and Gloria Loring, who is Robin Thicke's mom.
Yes.
But then we go on, week four, Rebecca Holden. Guess what she was in? She was in Playboy. Week five, you don't have anybody really, in terms of a token bimbo, somebody who may have been in adult magazines, but Audrey Landers is certainly, I mean, she's beautiful. She's a little, let's say, lightheaded. I don't want to be mean and stereotype blondes, but let's just say her blonde side was coming out. And that's just on, and we haven't seen Match Game Hollywood Squares how she did, but just based on her track record on the regular Match Game back in the late 70s and early 80s. And then Karen Witter's another one. That's week six. Vicky McCarty was in Playboy week seven. Don't ask me how I know these people are in Playboy. I got it on Wikipedia. Wink, wink, wink. Victoria Holman, I believe, was a model of some sort and might have done it. And then you've got the week of Leave It to Beaver. And then just like some of the other names, just people I've never heard of, and some people that don't even have any sort of like Wikipedia page or real entry in IMDb outside of Christine Claridge was best known for Match Game Hollywood Squares, parentheses, 1984. So, yeah, I mean, just look at the names. Christine Claridge. Jenna Lee Harrison was on week 11. She was actually on Three's Company, and she was not a ditzy bimbo.
No, even not though, unlike
even you may want to classify her as one for that week. But just looking at the listings for every week, there's invariably one name, and it's usually a female name that I've never heard of. And I'm not going to stereotype by calling them ditzy bimbos, because actually after looking at some of the names yesterday, they were soap opera stars. And obviously that was sort of a demographic they were trying to get to watch the show, because Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour aired at 3 p.m., at least Eastern. So that was the perfect time for the soap opera watchers, for the General Hospital watchers, and the whatever would have been on CBS at the time, As the World Turns, I believe. So, yeah, they're trying to bring in those viewers, too. But, yeah, just like I said, there's like invariably one name that I've never heard of. But they did get some interesting celebrities. They did.
Oh, yes.
Some of the names that you may not have recognized back then, but are definitely recognizable now. Jay Leno did a couple of weeks. As much as we may hate saying that name. And Arsenio Hall did a number of weeks.
Yes. Unfortunately, I wish Burton Richardson had been there to introduce him.
That would have been good. That would have been epic.
Oh, man.
But
imagine
then,
the crowd in NBC Burbank doing the woo, woo, woo.
I don't know if they would have done the woo, 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 but yeah, extending that O out for like 10 seconds, that would have been great. But Burton was probably, what, six or seven years away from announcing. I mean, Arsenio Hall would have been like 89, maybe 88. So that was easily 5-6 years away.
Well, hold up, Mike. Ed Begley Jr. established in week two he had a time machine.
No, Ed Begley Jr. was established. He was on St. Elsewhere.
No, I'm talking about the time machine he talked about in week two.
Jeez.
We talked about this. The tortoise that runs on vegetable oil.
Another inside joke. I'm sorry. But then week 10, which is the first full week of 1984. And we've actually tried looking into this to see what he was doing at the time. Why would he be on Match Game Hollywood Squares as a panelist? David Ruprecht.
Yes, David Ruprecht, who, of course, we all now know for Supermarket Sweep, for some reason is on the first week in 1984.
The only thing we could gather is in the last few episodes of Three's Company, he played somebody's boyfriend, I believe. But the thing is, those episodes probably would have aired like May of 84 or April of 84. And the only other thing I can think of that David Ruprecht would have done was he did that movie, the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island or whatever it was.
Yes, he played Thurston Howell the Fourth.
Yeah, he played Thurston Howell the Third or the Fourth. No, Thurston Howell Third was on the TV show. Yeah, Thurston Howell the Fourth. So we're sort of stumped as to what David Ruprecht would have done in early 84 to merit a spot on the panel. And then just going through the list, looking for other names, as mentioned, Jay Leno already. We know who this person is, Bill Cullen.
Yes.
The legend. It's going to be interesting to see those shows because from what I've heard, Bill didn't walk across the stage for semi-obvious reasons if you know about Bill Cullen. So he just stood at his lectern, where he was sitting, and sort of gave a wave or may have stood up. Let's see here. Just going through this real fast to see if... Oh, Sally Julian. February of 84, Sally Julian. What was she doing? Because she was off Sale of the Century by that time, I believe.
I don't know. Maybe she was still under NBC contract.
Possibly, but there's another token bimbo of the week.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And then you had the usual stars coming on to pitch their shows. Bill Cullen would have pitched Hot Potato, most likely. Bob Eubanks was on. He would have been pitching Dreamhouse. Let's see here.
Were you waiting for me to make a Dreamhouse joke?
Not really. I'm just looking through the list. But yeah, and then they brought on more stars for their new shows. They had Paula Kelly on, who was on Night Court. Richard Mall, who was on Night Court. Marky Post was on, but she would have been on The Fall Guy at the time.
Yeah, because who was the first attorney at the time?
That was Paula Kelly, I believe.
Okay.
Or Ellen Foley. Ellen Foley, yeah, I believe. Was the first.
Okay.
Yes, so, Ellen Foley, then it was Paula Kelly for the second season, I believe. Or maybe, well, it was either Paula Kelly or Ellen Foley. I think it was Foley first. Or no, Ellen Foley was who Mac Robinson was, the court reporter.
Okay.
So yeah, it may have been Paula Kelly first, because Paula Kelly definitely was on this, and she was definitely on Night Court, at least for the first season, if not the second season until Marky Post became available because Fall Guy wasn't on there anymore.
Okay. And of course, Marky Post, forgot to mention, former Mark Goodson, Bill Todman employee.
She worked on Double Dare. She was a card turner occasionally on Card Sharks. Yeah, so she's totally familiar with the Mark Goodson family. There's actually no other names here that I see that we'd recognize as future stars. So there is a little bit of maybe untapped talent there. I mean, Jay Leno was a known commodity, love him or hate him, back in 1983. He was doing appearances on Carson and stand-up stuff. But one thing we haven't covered, the music.
Oh, yes. The music.
The music. I mean, this might be the most bombastic piece of game show music in history, with the horn section and just the way the open was. You have this big light board which literally stretches across the stage, or at least the visible part of the stage that you saw on TV, and it's flashing the names, and out comes the celebrity with their name in, you know, 20-foot high letter or 15-foot high letters, and the theme is just classic. I mean, once you hear it, you sort of get little tingles because you know you're in for something special.
Oh, yes, and it's so... The way Gene Wood, the famous Goodson Todman announcer, announces the show, "It's time for the match game! Hollywood Squares! Hour! With..." And then you get, then you see the name pop up, and then the walks down, you're excited. Then the next name comes up, and the next person walks down, you're excited. It makes it feel like this is going to be an epic show you're about to watch.
And this was like top-of-the-line graphics probably in 1983. I mean, this is something that really, that light board, you saw in like 50 Grand Slam, kind of, sort of, back in 1976, but not to this degree. I mean, that light board was comparatively smaller, but still, it was a very high-tech piece of machinery for 76. But yeah, that board, you knew you were in for something special, and I don't know, at least for me, I know you weren't around at the time, or at least if you were, you're in diapers, so you didn't really watch it, per se.
I would have been 2 months pregnant with my mom would have been 2 months pregnant.
I would say you would have been 2 months pregnant? Boy, science is amazing.
No. Oh, Jesus.
But yeah, I was 9 years old at the time. Actually, at the start of the show, in October of 83, I would have been eight. And I was in I would have been in fourth grade in 1983-84. And I remember we would be dropped off from school. It was probably about 2:50 to 2:55, so that was just enough time to kick off your shoes, turn on the TV, get a little comfortable, and here's the theme music, the epic theme music, and this big signage on stage, and even as a 8-year-old, 9-year-old, I recognized some of the names. Yeah, there were names at the time. I mean, I used to watch Real People as a little kid, so I knew who Skip Stevenson was, and I heard of, you know, some of the other names. Some of the other celebrities, like I said, I didn't know anything about the adult magazines at the time, nor do I now. Wink, wink, wink. But yeah, like you said, you knew you were coming in for like something special. This is like akin to Price is Right. You've got the flashing light border. You've got Johnny Olsen saying, "Come on down." It's really one of the epic openings of game shows. Not that a game show would have lasted a longer time because they opened, but it's one of those that you remember. And speaking of the announcers, you mentioned Gene Wood. Gene Wood was the perfect announcer for that show, just like he was the perfect announcer for Card Sharks, at least the NBC version from 78 to 81. The reason I say that, he has like the timing and cadence down. He knew how to read the poems at the right, you know, the right cadence, the right timing, and he knew when to do that on Card Sharks. He did the same here. Perfect timing. And I'll give you the counterexample for both of them. There was a while, I believe in 80 and maybe 81, when Gene Wood didn't announce, because he was a busy guy at the time. He would have done Family Feud at the time. And not just Family Feud on daytime, but he also did the nighttime version.
Yes.
And you know, this wouldn't have coincided with Card Sharks, but he did Child's Play at the time. Again, that's 82 to September of 83, so that's right before Match Game Hollywood Squares. But thing is, he was a busy guy. I mean, you're talking about 10 episodes of Family Feud a week, plus 5 of Match Game Hollywood Squares, which is an hour-long show. So you're essentially doing... You're doing 10 hours of shows per week, or the equivalent of 20 half-hour shows. That's a lot of work. So they brought in some substitute announcers. They had on Card Sharks, like, Johnny Olson did a few episodes, and I think Jack Nars did a few episodes, or Art James, I think, did a few episodes. Bob Hilton did some, and they just didn't get that timing right. So you'd have, like, the poem read really quickly, and then you have on Card Sharks, and then like 3 seconds later they'd zoom into the logo. That's something that Gene Wood had down pat and was missing, and the same thing was true of Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour. There is footage online of one episode of Johnny Olsen's announcing, and he just does not get the timing right. I mean, he's a great announcer, probably the best ever.
He's one of the legends.
He's one of the best, but the thing is, for the Hollywood Squares part, yeah, if you saw the light board on the back, there was a certain timing. It's the Match Game, and there's up flashes the name, Match Game. Hollywood Squares, up flashes the name, Hollywood Squares. Hour, the word hour flashes up. When Johnny Olsen did this, it was, stay tuned for the second half of Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour. And you see the lights in the background. Match Game. Hollywood Squares. Hour. And he just totally screwed up the timing. Again, that might be just because Gene was just used to doing that show. I mean, obviously we said there were 191 shows, and let's say Gene did at least 150 of them or 140 of them. You know the rhythm. You're used to it. Johnny Olsen just didn't have it. But
it's one thing if it's The Price is Right, you know, for Johnny. It's, you know, this person come on down, this person come on down, and then, you know, you're the next 4 contestants on The Price is Right. You know, he's used to doing that formula for, like, so many times. And I'm sure if the reverse happened, it would feel weird. So, I mean, when Johnny's placed into this other environment where you have someone who's established the rhythm of the show, it becomes very different and weird.
And that's exactly what I was just going to say. Johnny was in his environment at Price is Right. I mean, he had done it at that time 11 years. So, yeah, it's almost like riding a bicycle at that point for him. You put him on a different show with different pacing, he's probably not going to respond properly unless, you know, Mark Goodson pulled him to the side and said, okay, you've got to do it this way, put a pause in when you see this. Do it again. Yeah, so it happens. I mean, but the thing is, Gene Wood was like the perfect host for it. And actually, speaking of Price is Right, the theme. People may remember it from Match Game Hollywood Squares, but for, I would say, almost the better part of 25 years, if you heard that theme on Price is Right, you knew you were playing for a very nice car. This wasn't like Chevy Chevelle or Ford Pinto or an AMC Gremlin type of car. You were playing for a Lincoln Town Car or a Corvette or something in that stratosphere. That was the bombastic theme used to say, hey, you're playing for a car that's worth $30,000, $35,000, not a little, you know, $8,000 Geo Metro or something like that. And it's sad they got rid of that music. Not just that cue, but the entire package. But you knew something was special when you heard that music, when you heard the first couple notes, when you heard that, yeah, the first second, which you'd hear in the open to Match Game Hollywood Squares, you knew something big was happening.
Oh, yes.
And there's actually one last thing we haven't talked about yet. I know we're going a little long here. We wanted to do about an hour, but it's our podcast.
And also, Buzzer's been rerunning it recently, the last 2 weeks with their new fall schedules. So.
Oh, and that's another thing we should add is, like, of all the entries that we're doing, this is probably one of the few that's actually being rerun on TV right now. So if you've got Buzzer on your system and want to catch this, it's on every weeknight at 10 o'clock Eastern, p.m. Eastern, and it also reruns on the weekends, too. Definitely give it a look. I mean, this is... It's a piece of history in some ways, and it's very polarizing. You either really love it or you really hate it. There really isn't like, it's sort of good. It's either you're diehard, oh, this is like, how did this last just 9 months? Or you're like, this should have been off the air by February of 84. But there's one last thing, and this is sort of a segue into next week's episode. One thing that we've noticed as we watched these first 2 to 3 weeks of Match Game Hollywood Squares, as we said earlier, they're really pushing NBC shows. You've got Terry Copley or Tom Villard from We've Got It Made, or you've got this celebrity from this show. You know, we said Skip Stevenson from Real People. One thing, and this may be either NBC, either just with due to the amount of advertising for this show, or it might be maybe the network just told them, okay, we need you to promote this show because this show is so innovative and we need higher ratings. Or maybe there's just, it just somehow just made the circuit early on in November of 83 that this show was a dog. But there have been at least, I'd say at least 4 references to a show called Mr. Smith.
Mr. Smith, yes. Oh.
And this is a show that, even though, like I said, it's gotten plenty of mentions, at least 4 or 5. I mean, there were even questions written about Mr. Smith on Hollywood Squares.
You could tell that they thought Mr. Smith was going to be a hit. This was like how in the early teens, how NBC thought, oh my God, everyone's going to love Whitney Cummings. We gotta put 75% of our advertising behind this.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't unlike other shows you may be hearing about in the near future, possibly, where NBC or Fox or whatever network pushes like their entire advertising budget during the World Series or the Super Bowl or the Olympics, that you got to watch this new show when it comes out on September 28th, even though the Olympics are happening in July 28th. Oh, this show's so good, we're pushing it 2 months in advance. And it turns out to be a dog. It turns out to be a topic of this podcast. And there actually is an example of that, which may or may not come up in the near future. I'll mention it. Back in the 07 World Series, Fox was pushing the Rich List. Oh, there were so many advertisements for the Rich List. And the show lasted 1 episode. So, it's the same thing with Whitney. NBC was barraging us with Whitney. Whitney's the next big thing. Whitney, Whitney, Whitney. And that must have happened with Mr. Smith, because, again, the celebrities are making mentions of Mr. Smith. There was a question about Mr. Smith in terms of what is Mr. Smith most likely going to do before he goes to sleep. Eat cookies and drink milk, or have relations with a female orangutan? The answer is cookies and milk. Sorry.
You know, I think Mr. Smith would have been a much better show if he had, like, a female orangutan.
Oh, there might have been a Mrs. Smith. The problem is there's so little footage of Mr. Smith on YouTube, and we'll get into that the next installment. But it's just Mr. Smith, Mr. Smith, Mr. Smith. There was a question on Match Game about the definition of ugly has a picture of blank next to it, and what does Nedra Vole say? Mr. Smith. And I think that actually sort of started us on the Mr. Smith track. Who the heck is Mr. Smith? And we'll definitely get into who Mr. Smith is next week. But and also, you know, it's kind of interesting because Mr. Smith is next week. Greg, who's a celebrity on Match Game Hollywood Squares reruns this week on Buzzer?
Oh, it's going to be Mr. Leonard Fry, Mike.
From Mr. Smith.
From Mr. You know, I cannot wait because it's, let's see, today as we're recording this, it's Sunday. So let me see. At the time
Wait. It's Saturday.
Oh, it's Saturday. I'm sorry. I got my dates of the weekend mixed up.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm sorry. I was in Ed Begley Jr.'s artist that runs on vegetable oil all week. So
correct me, Greg, if I'm wrong, but I believe as of the time we're recording this, we are 51 hours and 10 minutes away from hearing Gene Woods say, "From Mr. Smith, Leonard Fry."
Oh my God, that's going to be so epic. Gene Wood has said so many great things in game show history. I mean, one thing we talked about was when Buzzer did the International Women's Day marathon, they had the Family Feud 94 episode with Carol Burnett and Betty White, where he introduced it like a big prize fight.
Yes.
I'm sorry, but this when he says "from Mr. Smith, Leonard Fry," you know that those are going to be the five greatest words he's ever spoken in the history of the medium.
And we're not joking. We're really anticipating seeing this because, again, Mr. Smith is this big thing. NBC's big hit for fall of 1983, and it doesn't even see 1984, which seems almost typical of most shows on NBC in 1983 because, not spoiling anything, there's more besides Mr. Smith, which you may or may not hear about in the near future. Let's just give it up. You're going to hear about these shows. They were still a year away from really hitting the jackpot with Cosby Show and Night Court.
In the term 20, in the year 2019, the term "hitting the jackpot with Cosby" doesn't really mean.
But the thing is, in a 1984 sense, it does, but I totally get what you mean. We don't want to give Mr. Cosby more credit than he deserves.
No.
But the thing is, in 1984, his show was the thing, whether we want to admit it or not. So, yeah, next week, Mr. Smith, you're going to go ape over it. Ha, 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 ha. He's not an ape, he's an orangutan. So, yeah, we'll have that next week. In the meantime, we are on social media. We have plenty of presences. We are on Jack Dorsey's Twitter machine at twitter.com/ It was a thing on TV. I almost forgot the name of the podcast. Oh, my gosh. It was a thing on TV. We're also on Tumblr at itwasathingontv.tumblr.com. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/itwasathingontv. And you can find the podcast at itwasathingontv.podbean.com. So for Greg Diener, this is Mike Klaus. We'll see you next week when we talk about Mr. Smith.
You'll go ape.
It didn't work the first time. you'll go bananas for it. Bye-bye. Talk to you later. 'Greg, you got your Hollywood Squares in my match game.
Oh, man. You know, that just goes right together, doesn't it, Mike?
That's not the joke!
What? That's not the joke.
You got your peanut butter in my chocolate. You got your chocolate in my peanut butter.
Oh, okay.
So you say, Okay, we found an outtake for the end of the show.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following. Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed. We dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the It Was a Thing on TV podcast, episode 2, submission 002, Mr. Smith, which aired on NBC from September 23rd of 1983 to December 16th of 1983 for a total of 13 episodes. Hi, I'm Mike Klaus, and Greg Diener is back here again. Hello, Greg.
Hello, and Mike, we have our third co-host with us for the very first time on this podcast.
Yes, the third half of this podcast is with us.
Finally!
Finally, it's the one and only Chico Alexander.
The third half of the podcast that is the... this part of the third trilogy. I don't know how this is going to work here.
The math works somehow. I don't know how we got there.
Well, you're the math teacher, so yeah.
Oh, sure. Put it on me. So we're here today to talk about Mr. Smith. This is sort of a segue from last week because Mr. Smith, we first found out about it when watching these Match Game Hollywood Squares reruns maybe about 3 weeks ago. And they had many questions about Mr. Smith, which in turn had made us have many questions about Mr. Smith, and we have some answers. Unfortunately, we're not going to talk much about the show itself because there just isn't any video out there.
And
Greg actually had an idea for that. Tell him your idea.
Well, my idea is we should, after this episode, and I found out that Mr. Smith is owned by Paramount Television, which means it's in the CBS Viacom family. So after this episode, Mike, I'm going to go down to the CBS offices. I'm going to go down to picket in front of the CBS offices demanding, we want Mr. Smith on CBS All Access.
Or at least on Hulu or Netflix or Amazon Prime, someplace that the masses can enjoy this for the first time in 36 years.
Hey, Mike, if they can reboot the XFL, I'm sure they can reboot Mr. Smith.
Well, in the course of team...
Can I bring something up here?
Absolutely. The chair recognizes the chairman.
You said Mr. Smith is owned by CBS Viacom, right?
Yes.
So is Pluto TV.
Oh!
Right?
I see where he's going.
Mr. Smith on a Mr. Smith channel on Pluto TV, the same 13 episodes run over and over again, I'd watch it.
Would anybody else?
No.
Have you seen the obscure stuff they have on Pluto?
Yes, sir, I have.
Yeah, they got obscure stuff on Pluto. It's called Buzzer. So about Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith is another attempt to use simian creatures on television with marginal success. There was J. Fred Muggs on the Today Show back in the 50s. And you had in the 70s, early 70s, you had Lancelot Link, which lasted all 13 episodes. Oh, maybe we might have another entry there somewhere down the road. There's been other instances of using monkeys, gorillas, apes on TV shows. Obviously, Friends had Marcel. Not that Marcel did anything besides act like a little monkey. But 1983's Mr. Smith was a little different because Mr. Smith really was the main character. Briefly, Mr. Smith, and I'm taking this from the 1983 TV Guide Fall Preview, oh, by the way, which had Mr. Smith as one of three characters on the cover. So if that didn't say that NBC wasn't like banking everything on this, nothing does.
It wouldn't be the biggest gamble NBC ever paid.
No, definitely not the biggest.
That comes down the line, I think.
That's spoiler. That's a later date. We know what we're talking about. Mr. Smith, in addition to being on the fall TV preview installment of TV Guide in 1983, he also had his own cover. So in the span of 3 months, this bum got on the cover of TV Guide twice. And Joni Loves Chachi only got on once. Where is there justice in this world? Now, I don't know about that, but it's just amazing how much NBC pushed this. And we're going to get into that in a second. I do want to read the capsule that NBC, or rather TV Guide, has here for Mr. Smith, which probably will sum up the show and give you enough information, that all the information you need to know. The star of this series, Mr. Smith, has an IQ of 256, plays chess, and writes treatises on thermonuclear dynamics. Okay, I need to compose myself.
You'll see why he's laughing in a moment, friends.
Well, as Alfred Hitchcock might say, you can imagine the producers had to scour Hollywood for an actor who could simulate intelligence. Ha 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 ha. The result of their search is pictured at right. Mr. Smith is a talking orangutan who, in an ambitious attempt to make Washington even funnier than it is, works as a special consultant to the U.S. government, helping out with little problems like MX missile policy. With a premise like that, it's safe to assume we'll hear a monkey joke or two. Mr. Smith works for peanuts. TV Guide actually wrote that. Mr. Smith works for peanuts. As our hairy hero copes with his dumb but likable owner, Tammy. Maybe it's Timmy. It looks like Tammy.
I think it's Tommy.
Tommy. Okay. Well, it would be kind of weird for a person named Tammy to be played by Tim Dunnigan. Tommy's little sister, Ellie, Laura Jacoby, a pretty psychologist, Tracy, and I can't read that word. Maybe malicious? I can't see what that word is. Liaison man? No. Leonard Fry was not malicious. A liaison.
Well, how do we know this? Because there's no episodes on YouTube.
Yeah, there's no footage, so how would we know?
Well, we got an open, but the open doesn't have Leonard Fry. He is some sort of tillicious liaison man, Raymond Leonard Fry. Raymond is on the prickly side, But who wouldn't be playing second banana to an ape?
Maybe he was the Dr. Smith to the robot.
Yeah, the Dr. Smith to the Mr. Smith.
He was the Dr. Smith to the Mr. Smith. Or the Dr. Smith to the Mr. Who or something like that. So the one thing that I noticed regarding the episodes, at least the episode guides, the listing of the shows, the episode names themselves, it's sort of like a precursor to Monk. If you've ever seen Monk, it's always Mr. Monk gets a colonoscopy, Mr. Monk visits the moon, Mr. Monk finds his long-lost brother. That's sort of the case here, except for a number of episodes. The first episode, actually the first two episodes, it's a two-parter. Welcome to Washington, part one and part two. But then, Mr. Smith finds his brother. More about that in a bit, right, Greg?
Yes. Oh, yes. That'll be so great. I can't wait to tell you all about Mr. Smith's brother.
Mr. Smith operates. And actually, I found the capsule from one of the TV magazines about that. Mr. Smith was actually like making recommendations for an operation on a CIA or FBI agent. I'm not even kidding. Oh, here we go. Talking about finds his brother. Number five, Mr. Smith rescues Bobo.
Bobo!
Number six, Mr. Smith falls in love. Aww.
Aww. Because that's what you do when you're a monkey working. When you're a monkey with high intelligence working in Washington with monkeys of low intelligence, you fall in love.
Well, was Mr. Smith making love to, was falling in love with a human, or was he falling in love with a fellow orangutan? I'm going to guess falling in love with a human. That'd be pretty weird.
Greg, do you really want me to go search while we're doing this? I can, and I will.
Oh, Jesus, I shouldn't have said anything.
Greg, I just want, while Mike is looking for that, I just want to point out one thing. You just mentioned a monkey falling in love with a human as weird. Because a talking monkey with a 256 IQ is not weird.
No, it's absolutely normal, of course. and actually, I'm sorry, I have the capsule from TV Guide for that.
I just wanted to say, when you said Mr. Monk finds his long-lost lover, I was almost chuckling a bit in the background because I was picturing the thought of Tony Shalhoub trying to find his long-lost brother. Well, Mike, I have a TV Guide listing in front of me on that episode regarding the surgery. Do you want me to
read it? Oh, you mean episode four, Mr. Smith Operates.
Yes. Here it is. And I'm not making any of this up. In the plot description, Mr. Smith disagrees with a top brain surgeon, and it has the actor's name, which I'm not making up, Olaf Pooley. What a name! Mr. Smith disagrees with a top brain surgeon about a risky surgical procedure planned for an important space scientist.
Okay, a monkey talking to a brain surgeon, I don't know how to. That's just too crazy.
Also, if you're the brain surgeon and you're why would you be getting advice from an orangutan with a high IQ? It's like you're the expert brain surgeon. Why are you taking advice from this simian?
Because apparently he doesn't know any better. Remember, he's a doctor.
Because it's 1983 NBC. Enough said.
Yes.
So Mr. Smith falls in love. I found the capsule for that.
Okay.
Mr. Smith falls for a female orangutan who gives TV weather forecasts.
Wait, it gets better than that.
Oh my god. I gotta sit down here.
Yeah, wait, there's more. Let me repeat that without laughter because save it for the end. Mr. Smith falls for a female orangutan who gives TV weather forecasts, but she in turn falls for Bobo!
And it's just
You know what? It's the Fabulous Baker Boys 5 years early. Except, am I right, or am I right?
Except, I didn't know Boba was a player.
Except Jeff and Bo Bridges did it better than Mr. Smith and Bobo.
Oh my gosh.
We haven't even gotten halfway through all the episode titles. After Mr. Smith falls in love, and then Bobo steals the female TV forecasting, weather forecasting orangutan away, we have number 7, Mr. Smith gets a physical. Also in that same episode, Mr. Smith rips off a doctor's face after the doctor says, turn your head and cough.
Oh, God. That sounds painful.
Imagine how it was for Mr. Smith. Number 8, goodbye, Mr. Smith. But he's not gone because that's episode 8. We still have 5 to go. Number 9, Mr. Smith loses a friend. And I think that when I actually saw the capsule for that too, I think Mr. Smith actually gives a eulogy at a funeral. I'm not even kidding.
Oh, can you imagine Mr. Smith giving a eulogy at a funeral? Here to give this eulogy is a talking orangutan that has a 256 IQ.
Number 10, Mr. Smith plays Cyrano. Against Steve Burke did it better 5 years later. Number 11, Mr. Smith makes a commercial. Number 12, Mr. Smith goes public. And the final episode, which apparently didn't air, or at least there's no date attached to it, Mr. Smith goes to court.
I can only imagine what that was about.
This is why we need Mr. Smith on one of these streaming services. We need to find out why Mr. Smith went to court.
And after that, Mr. Smith went bye-bye.
Mr. Smith says goodbye to the unaired 14th episode.
Mr. Smith says bye-bye, and we don't know what happened to Bobo. Did he run off with the weather-predicting orangutan? Who knows? Did they end up on Cheaters 17 years later? Who knows?
Okay. Do you want me to discuss Bobo now?
Tell us about Bobo, please.
Okay, well, a while back, maybe a week or two ago, me and Mike were searching for pictures of stupid television shows in preparation for this podcast for potential topics. And one of the photos we found was from Mr. Smith. And it's a picture of Leonard Fry with Mr. Smith and his brother, Bobo. Now, I'm going to read to you the back of this picture, okay?
And you found this on... This is one you found on eBay.
Yes. All right, NBC...
This is one nearly one of us bought on eBay.
Oh, you damn bet I was considering buying this. NBC Photo, Press Department, 30 Rock, New York, New York. And the title for this is, What a Family! Exclamation point. All in caps. Okay. Lovable talking genius Mr. Smith and his slower brother Bobo. Let me read it. Mr. Smith and his slower brother Bobo give Mr. Smith's personal secretary, Raymond Hoyt, Leonard Fry, plenty to worry about between national crises and playful antics in the imaginative new comedy series Mr. Smith, Fridays, 8:30 p.m., New York time, premiering this fall on NBC.
Boom, boom, boom. And actually, that was the more offensive description of Bobo, the slow brother. The other places I've seen him called dim-witted, which is a little more correct, let's say, politically correct. So, yeah, I'm sort of flabbergasted. I don't know where to go with this now.
Let me describe the picture. The picture, Bobo is completely naked wearing a hat.
Because aren't we all?
But Mr. Smith is at least dressed in a suit.
Well Bobo's dim-witted. He doesn't know how to dress himself, apparently. Oh, my gosh. I don't know how to top that, so we're just going to move on. Mr. Smith was probably, and Greg and I were talking about this, the best way of comparing this, the amount of promotion that went into Mr. Smith, is how much promotion NBC gave Whitney back in 2012, 2011?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where they just, like, pushed it down your throat, and that show, Whitney, lasted two seasons at most. And if you ask Greg, it's one of the least funny shows ever.
Oh, it's one of the worst. That's why we canceled after the first commercial break.
And then the show that she actually created, Two Broke Girls, I think Greg thinks the same of that, and I definitely do. I cannot stand Two Broke Girls. And that lasted 5 years.
Well, Mike, there are two reasons why that show lasted 5 years. And you know what they are.
Yes, I do.
It's Kat Dennings.
Kat Dennings, the left one, and Kat Dennings, the right one. Oh, my. So, yeah.
Are you trying to say that Kat Dennings has enormous talent?
Yes. Amazing talents.
Because she does, you know. She's a genuinely funny individual.
Oh, I'm not doubting that at all.
You know, I almost feel like I should pull up the screen grab from Match Game Hollywood Squares this week of Leonard Fry holding the card that says boobies on it. So, yeah, about the NBC hype machine. Oh, my gosh. I mean, they did everything to make this show succeed. And actually, this show should be, this episode of the podcast, rather, not Mr. Smith, but this episode should be called, like, Too Hyped to Fail, yet it did. Because NBC did all sorts of stuff to generate interest. First, as we've mentioned last week, Match Game Hollywood Squares, there are so many mentions of Mr. Smith, Mr. Smith, Mr. Smith. There's questions about Mr. Smith. There's answers of Mr. Smith. And again, that sort of brought us to looking at what is Mr. Smith. And then we went down that rabbit hole, and this is the result of it. And specifically, I think Greg had been anticipating something happening for the last month or so, or 3 weeks. And here it is. This comes from this past Monday on Buzzer, this past Monday, the 14th of October.
Fantastic. That was the greatest thing Gene Wood has ever said in his entire career. As I said, it was worth all the hype.
You were looking forward to that, and your only regret is that we only heard that for 4 days, because that was the Thanksgiving week.
Oh, but there was something even better that week.
Oh, what?
Did you happen to catch on the Wednesday show, and we're going to bring this up, that Gene brings up to Leonard that Leonard and Mr. Smith were going to be in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade?
And that's actually the next thing I wanted to talk about. Yes, Leonard Fry and Mr. Smith, they were in the NBC Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in 1983. And, I mean, this is going to be a totally separate episode in and of itself. But, like, the entire Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade that year was, like, only NBC stars. Only NBC cartoons. If you looked at it, I mean, yes, they had Mr. Smith and Leonard Fry. There was Bowser, or rather John Bauman, I should say. He was a little more professional at the time for Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour. There was the cast of We've Got It Made on a float. Another show that didn't last much longer than Thanksgiving of 1983.
Mike,
we had Matt McCoy singing at the parade.
Yes, we did. But still, it's another show that barely lasted past Thanksgiving. It would be rebooted later, which, again, might be another episode. Wink, 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 wink. And you had... Oh, Care Bears and Shirt Tales, and I don't think the Smurfs were on there.
I think weren't the Care Bears on another network?
They might have been syndicated if I...
Care Bears
was on ABC, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't think the cartoon was out in 83. I think it was like 84 the Care Bears came out. So maybe there were free agents at the time. But, I mean, like, the only thing that's missing, and this might be an anachronism, is, like, where's the friggin' Snorks?
That is an anachronism.
That's a year later?
I think we're about 3 years away from the Snorks.
No! The Snorks wasn't 86.
I'm wikiing that now.
I'm on wiki right now.
Snorks was the next year in 84.
Yes, September of 84... And it lasts until 89? Damn! Okay, we must have been very bored as kids back in the mid-80s. Wow. Okay, and they did have Alvin and the Chipmunks, and Alvin and the Chipmunks had premiered on NBC Saturday mornings in 83. So again, like, everything they showed, it was all NBC.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so Mr. Smith and Leonard Fry were in a vehicle in the parade, and this can be found at about an hour and 31 minutes into the parade. You can find it on YouTube. They didn't sing. It looked like all they were doing was waving. It's like, okay, we're not even good enough to sing. Just watch us tomorrow night, Friday night. It's the episode. Oh, let me see what episode was on. Oh, gosh, I hope he was getting a physical that night. No, it was Mr. Smith plays Cyrano.
Oh, yes. Come watch tomorrow night to see Mr. Smith with a giant nose.
Now, hold on. I'm just morbidly curious. I've got to see if that's what he really... Okay, oh, here we go. Yes, I found it. Wait. Oh, I found something else, too. Tommy asks Mr. Smith for courtship advice after falling for a lovely doctor. Now, wait a second. How old was Tommy on this show? Because I thought, you know, just based on the name Tommy, with all due respect to Tommy, a good friend of ours.
Tommy was played by Tim Zetigan before, I think it was like 5 years, 5 or 6 years before Captain Power and like... 2 or 3 years after the A-Team.
Okay, Timmy would have been Timmy. Tommy. Tim Dunnigan, that's his name.
Tim Dunnigan
was born in 55, so he would have been 28 at the time.
Yeah, Tim Dunnigan had Dirk Benedict's role from the A-Team in the pilot, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, your name's not Tommy unless you're Tommy Z at age 28. You're Tom! You're Thomas! But so, yeah, Tommy asks Mr. Smith for courtship advice after falling for a lovely doctor. Aww. I'm going to puke in a second. And I'm looking at the ratings for the week before. Yeah, Mr. Smith was 60th out of 64 shows. Jennifer Slept Here was 61st. Oh, and for Greg... Goodnight Beantown was 56th.
Oh, yeah. That's another thing. If you happen to watch the Friday episode of Magic Kingdom Hollywood Squares this past week, which would have been the Monday episode of Week 5, because as we mentioned, the week Leonard Fry was on Week 4 that aired this week, this past week on Buzzer, there were only 4 episodes because it was Thanksgiving week.
Yeah. But they more than made up for it with the references to the Macy's Day Parade on the Wednesday show.
Oh, and apparently Manimal didn't air that week. Oh, darn.
I think it was already on hiatus at that point, Mike.
No, because I told you, going through the ratings, we haven't even talked about this yet. Mr. Smith started its premiere week in 47th place. Now, again, mind you, it's out of probably 64, 65 shows. But by the end of its run, its final week, it was 63rd out of 65 shows. Only beating a TV show called First Camera, whatever that is, and that's perpetually at the bottom of the ratings in 83 from what I've seen. And it also beat out an ABC News special about the Pope and his Vatican. I wish I was kidding.
So from the sound of it, he was like, it was the absolute worst performing scripted show on that week.
So we talked about Thanksgiving Day Parade. We talked about Match Game Hollywood Squares.
Oh, wait, did you talk about the 900 number?
You beat me to it. We're going to talk about a 900 number.
A 900 number, Mike?
Yeah, a 900 number. And this is actually where the image that you see for this episode came from. There was a 900 number, 940 Smith. So that would be 90407, what's the M at?
Six.
So 6474. Yeah. So that number was a Mr. Smith hotline where at 50 cents a crack, you can call and get some sort of like insider scoop on Mr. Smith. Not like the Corey and Corey hotline of the 80s where, oh, he loves, you know, playing volleyball in the rain. No, like spoilers for the next episode. Yeah, spoiler. Mr. Smith's getting a physical, and he rips off the doctor's face when the doctor says, turn your head and cough. But the funny thing is, well, first off, the screen grab, it says that it's the second message from Mr. Smith. So there was one before it, and presumably more after it. Something interesting I found in the course of researching for today's show. It has to do with NBC and 900 numbers. Sometime around September, maybe August of 1983, NBC ran The Godfather, and they had a 900 number where you could call.
That was yours.
What was that? No, they invited.
Plenty for you to take to work in the morning.
Oh, it was the Godfather, probably.
They invited listeners to call your Godfather, and the number was what we just said, 900-407-6484. So apparently, if you look at this, they used the same number for the Godfather that they used for Mr. Smith. So they had plans to use this number all along. It isn't just happenstance, just coincidence that 900-407-6484 is the Godfather number. However, the Godfather phone line was a huge success. 160,000 callers, or over 160,000 callers, called that number at a cost of 50 cents apiece.
Whoa, that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of bananas.
As Gene Snyder would say, $80,000. You heard that, man, $80,000. Then NBC unfurled promos where viewers can call Mr. Smith. Smith is the orangutan hero of one of the network's fall debuting shows. Because, of course, it is. Also, just about Mr. Smith. Apparently, we joke about it, but apparently, and this is from a TV critic, the pilot episode was extremely well done. Those exact three words, extremely well done. The dialogue was crisp and funny. The technical tricks equally good. But one had to wonder how long such gimmickry would hold viewers' interest. I'd say about 13 weeks.
If that.
But another reason that Mr. Smith died, no, I shouldn't say died, his demise. We talked about the ratings, 47th to begin, and then down to third worst TV show on the week of its final episode. It had to do with the night of the week it aired, but also it had to air, to do with what also aired on NBC that night. And I'm going to use the numbers from the week, that last week of Mr. Smith. So Mr. Smith was 63rd out of 65 shows. After Mr. Smith was Jennifer Slept Here. And Jennifer Slept Here was rated 61st that week. And then after Jennifer Slept Here was Manimal. That was 59th that week. And that was on the Friday lineup. That was Friday night on NBC, which really historically not a lot of people watch TV because they're going to see movies, they're going out, they're doing anything but staying home. The thing is, NBC's fortunes would actually change the following year and 2 years later. Specifically on Friday nights, you had Miami Vice. I mean, Miami Vice is the consummate 80s show.
Oh, yes, when you think of the 80s, you think of Miami Vice.
Yep. Reeboks, no socks, baby.
MTV Cops.
But also, and this is another interesting little tidbit I dug up while doing actual show prep. The voice of Mr. Smith. The voice of Mr. Smith was done by Ed Weinberger. You should know the name, but if you don't, about a year later, he co-created probably the biggest show in the 80s and probably one of the biggest shows of all time if it wasn't for the legacy that the main star of the show created. Ed Weinberger created The Cosby Show. And Amen and Dear John and a couple other shows. But 12 months later, Ed Weinberger would create The Cosby Show, which was number one in the ratings from basically its entire run from 84 until 1992. So mm-hmm. when you hear Mr. Smith's voice on those reruns Greg's going to get, that's Ed Weinberger, the guy that co-created Cosby Show.
And I got some sad news, Mike. I looked up Ed Weinberger's Wikipedia. There is nothing about Mr. Smith on his Wikipedia.
Well, I didn't say that I found it on Wikipedia. Well, first off, we know Wikipedia is not always correct. Wait, what do you mean Mr. Smith had an IQ of 74 and picked his nose the entire show? Darn Wikipedia. Wait, Bobo had the IQ of 256. No. I'm sorry. Bobo is not the name of a person who has an IQ of 256 or even 156. That's a stereotypical name of somebody that have an IQ of 56. That's horrible now that I think about it. Poor Bobo.
And to label him as slow in the press release. Oh, come on, NBC. What the heck?
Well, Mr. Smith, that's for sure.
The heck were you thinking, Green Tinker?
Well, he wouldn't be around much longer.
Oh.
It died after 13 weeks, 3 months, and its legacy would live on a little bit. A little bit. We talked about Match Game Hollywood Squares. Leonard Fry still made appearances on Match Game Hollywood Squares long after Mr. Smith got canceled. I want to say he was on at least 3 or 4 more weeks, and he was just identified as Leonard Fry. Not to take anything away from Leonard Fry, but his resume is like really, really bland. He earned a supporting Oscar nomination in 1971 for Fiddler on the Roof, and then Mr. Smith, the end. I mean, that's essentially what his resume is, sadly. I mean, he did, you know, bit appearances, cameos. I saw he was on Murder, She Wrote, but he was not on many shows, at least in a lead capacity. And unfortunately, not to put a sour note on all this, Leonard Fry did pass away in 1988, just before the age of 50. He was 49. So, unfortunately, we don't know what Leonard Fry could have done because he had such a reasonably short life. But yeah, the legacy with Match Game Hollywood Squares, supposedly, even after Mr. Smith had been canceled, Match Game Hollywood Squares was still doing jokes about Mr. Smith. Whether NBC liked this or not is another story, but it did prove, I would assume it was good fodder for laughter. Even though they could have done Manimal jokes, they could have done Jennifer Sleutier jokes. I think the reason that they picked Mr. Smith is because this was the big show. This was promoted so much between the 900 number, the Thanksgiving Day parade. You heard what I said, the TV critics said about the pilot, that it was well done, and it just fell on its face. And sadly, all there is for us to see is a one-minute opening from the TV show, which you heard earlier.
And there's a bunch of promos for the Friday night lineup, including Mr. Smith on YouTube.
Yeah, but there's no actual footage in terms of, like from the show itself. Nobody wanted to waste that expensive videotape in 1983 salvaging 1 minute of this. Well, they did salvage 1 minute, but not 2 minutes. And we talked about NBC's horrible lineups, at least up until Miami Vice. But Miami Vice is on at 10 o'clock, though, so I'm going to give it a bit of a pass there. But the shows that followed on Friday night for ages on NBC might be covered on this podcast in the future. Specifically, I'm thinking of Misfits of Science, which came in 85. I can't think of many more, but the thing is, NBC never really had a hit on Friday nights outside of Miami Vice.
Nope.
I think we'll have to do more research on that. I'm sure a lot of stuff that aired between 8 and 10 on Friday nights, maybe since 83. Well, I mean, nowadays, it's a Dateline at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, and that's been running forever.
It's Keith Morris in town on Friday night, baby.
Would you please take a seat over there? Thank you.
No.
That's Chris Hansen, I know, but it's still in the Dateline family.
No, but Keith Morrison's the... So you witnessed the murder, huh? That must have been wild.
Spoiler, the boyfriend did it.
Ah!
But yeah, we talked about Manimal and Jennifer Slept Here. Should I say it, Greg?
What?
That we're covering those two shows in the next two episodes?
Oh yeah, we should. We should definitely say it.
Okay. Next week, we are covering Manimal, and actually it's a two-parter, Manimal, and we're going to cover Automan, because there's a little bit of overlapping between the two.
Even though technically Automan was not an NBC show.
It was on ABC, and it was on a different network at a different time.
It was on a different network, different time, ABC, but it was equally bad. It was actually laughable. I told Greg this, and I told Chico this. I saw something on YouTube. I think actually Chuck Wagner posted like 10 minutes from Automan, and I turned it off after 5 minutes because I couldn't just watch just see how stupid and insipid it was.
I can only imagine Mike watching Automan and 5 minutes in, leaving the room like, nope. Nope, I'm not going to watch anymore.
Well, guess what I'm doing is show prep for next week.
Watching a full episode of Automan.
At least making it through the 10 minutes of Automan. And then we're going to talk Manimal, which...
Oh, I can't wait. That's going to be great.
I don't even know if I can make 5 minutes.
And we're going to answer the question, is Simon McCorkadale and Chuck Wagner separated at birth? No, seriously, look at the two of them together.
Does one of them look like a panther and the other looks like a jaguar? No, there's another Automan joke in there, but I don't want to reveal too much of the plot line for next week. So, actually the week after that, number four is Jennifer Slept Here. And also, in case you're wondering, the episode numbers and the submissions aren't going to match. I'll tell you that right now, because next week is episode 3. But was Manimal and Automan, were they the third submission? No. I'm not going to tell you what number they are, but they're higher than 3. Higher than 4. No, not 5. But, yeah, we'll be here next week, and we're going to suffer our way through Automan and Manimal as our tribute to 1983 NBC continues. Do you just hear my enthusiasm when I say 1983 NBC?
Yeah, if you were any more excited, you would be Stonehenge.
Oh, I'm so excited for this. I can't even tell you. I cannot wait for this next week's episode. Because, oh, Manimal. Can't wait to finally talk about it. I'm going to love every second of it.
At least one of us is anticipating this.
Come on. I get to talk about Simon McCorkindale on the podcast. How many times am I going to talk about... I'm never going to talk about Falcon Crest on the podcast.
No, because it's lasted forever.
We can make exceptions.
Well, here's not true. We can.
We're not going to, but we can make exceptions. So, remember, you can find us on Twitter, on Tumblr, on Facebook, on Instagram. Oh, my gosh. I added an Instagram because apparently I want to be just as cool as the teenagers I teach at school. We're at all those with the handle It Was a Thing on TV. So find us at facebook.com/itwasthingontv, twitter.com/itwasthingontv, and on Tumblr at itwasthingontv.tumblr.com, and at Instagram at instagram.com/itwasathingontv. And then our main site is itwasathingontv.podbean.com. Maybe a domain will be coming soon. Maybe. We'll see. But for now, thank you to Chico, the third half of our group. I still can't get fractions right, I'm sorry. And thank you to Greg, as always. And I'm Mike Klaus, and we'll be back next week after suffering through Automan and Manimal. And if we have to suffer, you have to suffer. See you next week.